You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Welcome to the All Creatures Podcast. This is Chris, and I'm really excited today to have on two guests. We are going to be discussing big cats, big cat sanctuaries. I mean, this has obviously been something that has been in the news around the world, you know, with the documentary Tiger King, and then some latest news, too, in this coronavirus pandemic. I'm joined today with Emily McCormick from Turpentine Creek Wildlife Refuge, which is based in Arkansas here in the United States. She's the curator. And then also David Ender, who does quite a bit on big cats, but he was a former intern there too. So welcome, Emily and David.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Hello. Yeah. Thank you very much.
This is going to be awesome. So I guess just really quick, you know, if you can just give a brief background from our listeners, I guess, Emily, you could go first, you know, where you grew up and I guess kind of how you got involved at Turpentine.
Yeah, sure. So pretty much most of my childhood, I wanted to work with tigers or help tigers or, you know, so I went to school, got my zoology degree. I'm originally from Oswego, New York. That's upstate New York. And I got my degree and was looking around and saw the sanctuary where there was at that time over 100 big cats. And I came to Eureka Springs, Arkansas to do an internship, not even knowing the background and what was going on in the U.S. With the exploitation of these animals and why sanctuaries were necessary. And it became a very, very huge passion. I live my life by it and work to save these animals. So I've been here for just over 21 years now.
Wow. Wow. And then David?
Yeah, so I was studying conservation biology and took on an interest for big cats and decided to get some hands-on experience. It's not always easy when you tell your mother that you want to work with big cats. So saw this internship available at Turpentine Creek. Literally, the day I got there, I remember Emily toured me around and I still, nothing really clicked. Like I knew I was working with big cats, but I really didn't understand why they were there. Mm-hmm. And during my time there, just absolutely fell in love with this cause and saw how badly of a need there was to be caring for these rescued animals, to continue to rescue them. And most importantly, just to spread the mission and the right knowledge about the exotic pet trade and what needs to be done. And then after that, I went back to school and stayed very close to the sanctuary and all the people at Turpentine Creek, helped out where I could. And now I'm your typical student debt recovery program person. So jumping around right now, but still just helping out in any capacity I can.
It never ends. Trust me. It's years later and still paying off those dang loans. So, okay. I guess you always ask us like, you know, where'd your interest in wildlife begin? But for both of you, and we can go with Emily first. What is the draw about big cats? And, you know, we see this in this documentary. People, I mean, they're beautiful to look at and I love and admire lions and tigers and jaguars and leopards, but my goodness, I don't want to jump in a cage with them. So what's the draw?
So do you want the sane person draw or the insane person?
Both. Because the documentary definitely shows the insane
right,
part.
Right, right. So the sane people, you know, they're a beautiful creature and they're going extinct in the wild and, you know, people that want to fight for conservation and try to save them. I would say the insane part of it is definitely this like macho, typical, no offense, but I have tigers and I think I'm really cool and will it make me famous? And so we just saw through the Tiger King. Well, it kind of worked for them, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just this draw of like these animals are so, I mean, they could kill you. So the fact that these people think that they're so wonderful, they can, you know, control the animal, get in the cage with it, and they haven't been killed yet. And that shows this big stance. And, you know, it's become just a huge, huge issue in this country. And also, due to the lack of laws regulating this, it's been made easy for these people.
Mm-hmm. So, David, I know reading your bio, you know, you got to, and I'd like to talk about it at some point, you went to Kruger, but was this always a lifelong passion for you with the big cats, or is it just something that evolved?
Yeah, I don't, it kind of just came out of nowhere, to be honest. I always loved horses. I thought the horses, there's just something so majestic about them. And after that experience in Kruger and just sitting in a car all day, tracking GPS and different individuals of lions and really getting to understand their behavior, this was while I was in my undergrad. Taking my undergrad animal behavior course. And there was just something about the way they interacted with each other that was just fascinating to me. And I think that's what kind of kickstarted the direction into big cats.
Oh, their behavior's amazing. I mean, it's amazing. They're amazing. David, correct me if I'm wrong, but you did do some research down. Were you doing it in Kruger?
So I've done a bunch of research. I did a little bit in the wild. Over in Kruger, what we were doing is we were trying to create a catalog for individual cats throughout the park. So we were using both GPS, GIS software to track them along with different markings. But most of my research was during my master's program where we were really looking at the impact of cognitive evolution and cognitive ecology on animal welfare.
Okay, cool.
So that was very interesting. Yeah.
No, it's the more we do, the more big cats we do, we're just amazed. I mean, just amazed at behavior and some of the social aspects and things like that. So they're definitely awe inspiring for sure. Emily, I guess something we could put up front in the podcast is, can you just kind of describe Turpentine Creek? Because I think there's a lot of confusion right now out there in the public. What a real rescue is, or a real sanctuary versus what we saw in this documentary with Tiger King. And for those that didn't listen to our podcast on kind of our thoughts on Tiger King, for any listeners that didn't hear that, please understand that that was a drama produced by television producers or movie producers. It was a story they told. So when I watched it, I really tried to look at it from the animal's perspective. I mean, yeah, you're drawn into the human side and the human story, but again, from the animal's perspective. So I guess, again, Emily,
yeah,
what is your role and mission at Turpentine?
All right. Well, Turpentine Creek was founded in 1992 by Tanya Smith and her parents, Don and Hilda Jackson. And, you know, a lot of places, privately owned zoos, sanctuary, a lot of places started out in the same way. Got an animal as a pet. You know, we saw a different side of another sanctuary in that film, you know, and from the beginning, but the thing is change. And so Tanya's father, Don, had acquired a lion back in the late 70s and, saw this lion cub chained to a tree. Offered the guy in exchange for a dirt bike to rescue this lion and brought it home. And he very quickly realized this is an African lion and I need to build it an enclosure. And some years later, some more people had gotten a lion as a pet and realized this is not good. And Don and Hilda offered to take her in. So that's the first two lions that they acquired. And then years down the line, they had moved to Hope, Arkansas. And one of these characters, not one in the film, but I mean, it's the same mentality of these people in the film is what we see on rescues every day. And so this woman drove onto their neighbor's property with 42 lions and tigers stuffed into three horse trailers. And it happened, and there's photos of it. And so Tanya and her family knew of this property in Eureka Springs and decided that they would come up here, take everything they had, every dollar they had, and invest it into this property and build some smaller enclosures to get those animals out of that situation. You know, they're defecating, urinating on each other, you know, fighting almost to death for food. And so they did that. And then crazy lady decides that she's going to leave and take all the animals. And so, you know, that's when the foundation was formed. And they started the sanctuary to where when they bring in and help a rescued animal, you know, that animal is going to come here and stay for the rest of its life. And that was pretty much the beginning in 1992. Through those years, we've grown and grown, and the refuge sits on 459 acres of land. So the potential for growth is phenomenal. One other thing they didn't touch on in that docuseries is that true sanctuaries are nonprofits. You know, mm-hmm. They did a lot to try to take, you know, pick apart at Big Cat Rescue, but nonprofits, you know, are trying to raise money to build new enclosures, to provide for the animals, to provide their food, to provide their enrichment, you know, the best animal care that can happen. So over the years, we've built, quite a few habitats. They range anywhere from 10,000 square feet to our most recent bear enclosure, which is 2.4 acres.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, one thing that's completely what people didn't get out of that, because it turned the docuseries Tiger King turned into a reality show, basically. They totally never took the animals' perspective on it. They showed a lot of abuse, mm-hmm. but did everyone see that? Because so many people are focused on these characters instead of what happens to the animal, you know? And so.
Oh, that's such a great point. Such a great point.
You know, I have in 21 years been on multiple rescues, dealt with multiple characters like this, mm-hmm. Maybe even some of them. And, you know, this mentality, I do believe that in some sort of way, I guess they all think they love their animals, you know, but then the dollar sign gets overwhelmed and they become just trying to do anything they can to be profitable for these animals. And there's absolutely no thought in the care of the animals or the respect for these creatures or anything of that sort. So I always look at the animal side of it. I mean, I was cringing watching the series, and I think of a lot of the animals and being on a rescue and going into a situation and seeing this terrified tiger. I mean, there's nothing more heart-wrenching than seeing an animal that is just, you know, can totally, I mean, it's so dangerous, and seeing this fear in them, mm-hmm. you know, and bringing them back to our sanctuary and watching them relax and trust in their environment and trust they're going to be fed and cared for and taken care of every day, watching that transition and for those animals is probably the most rewarding part of my job. And so for me, that series left me in this like, oh my God, what about those animals? You know, mm-hmm. where are mm-hmm. they today? Which is mm-hmm. truly what most people don't look at. And they're missing that definite fact of the animal aspect of this docuseries and also focusing on the drama they created on the people. And not, you know, what a true sanctuary is, what mm-hmm. Big Cat Rescue and Carol Baskin have been doing for animals and fighting for animals for many, many years.
Yeah, it seems like they kind of glossed over that, right? Like it was, you know, the one thing I have to agree with you And that's what it was hard. You know, it was funny because, you know, we just did that response with Corbin Maxing a couple weeks ago. And I was taking notes meticulously, nothing on the human aspect, you know, between Joe and Carol and all these characters, but more looking at the animals and watching. And I remember, I didn't even bring this up, but in the episode one, I think it's about the 21 minute mark, that one place that I don't name in South Carolina where it's a clouded leopard and she is dragging it by the collar across the stage in front of 30 something people.
Oh,
my jaw hit the ground. I'm like, that is abuse. That is horrific.
Yeah.
And you're right. Who saw that? I did, but most people wouldn't. So that's a great point. I guess really quickly, you know, what makes a sanctuary versus a, say, roadside zoo? Because we, you know, as we've the last couple of years navigated, you know, sanctuaries versus not sanctuaries, because I've seen it where somebody's private zoo is tagged as a quote unquote sanctuary.
Well, absolutely. They're getting smart about it, or so mm-hmm. they think. Let's change our name to this. Or, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of these horrendous places that absolutely have some great names that totally confuses people. But for sanctuaries, there is GFAS, which is the Global Federation of Animal Sanctuaries. Mm-hmm. And they are accrediting true sanctuaries, not just, you know, the word. It is the standards that they've set is very, very high, pretty comparable to AZA, if not a little bit more detailed in the fact that not only is it the highest standards for animals, but you have to include your emergency plans. What if there's a virus outbreak? Mm-hmm. What if there's, you know, a tornado? What if, and so all of that, but also it has to have a contingency plan, mm-hmm. right? Because the sanctuaries, if they're true, you know, like some of these roadside zoos, well, what happens if this happened last year? You know, so-and-so was killed in a helicopter or a plane crash. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen to all those animals? You know, that, so all of that goes into the accreditation of GFAS. And right now they're really the only true accrediting group that's doing that. And that's globally, that's for sanctuaries, mm-hmm. you know, worldwide. And so sanctuaries never breed, buy, good. Sell, good. Trade animals. Those animals, once they are rescued, they come to, this is their home forever. This is their mm-hmm. forever. And that's a true sanctuary. There's no cub petting. There's no, you know, we're breeding for conservation. No, you're not. Mm-hmm. You know, sanctuaries mm-hmm. are generally, most all are made up of generic animals, generic tigers, meaning not a purebred animal. So, yeah, we have been accredited by GFAS, and right now there's only 14 accredited sanctuaries in North America.
Oh wow.
For that have cats and for big cats. So that tells you something too. You need to do your homework before you go anywhere. You know, I'll say that probably 80 times throughout this talk, but and then there's 4 that are verified, meaning they're working towards their accreditation. So there's not many out there that are doing it. The accreditation process is every 3 years for reaccreditation or re-verification. And, you know, they're always pushing, you know, but globally there's 191 accredited sanctuaries. So that's the big difference in things that people look for. And by the way, you know, Big Cat Rescue in Florida has been an accredited sanctuary since 2009. So
right.
a lot of those things that they left out of the series.
Creating drama.
And, yeah, you know, absolutely.
I mean, that was the whole purpose behind it. David, do you want to jump in and kind of talk about your gut reaction to all of this?
Yeah, well, actually, just to piggyback off a couple things mm-hmm. that Emily was just talking about, I think it's really important for people listening to realize a lot of people are always like, well, how can I help? You know, and, mm-hmm. and maybe they don't have enough money to donate. And, you know, just to go off what Emily said, the easiest way that anybody can help is to just make sure you're going to an accredited facility. Because that money is going to, if you're entering or you're paying admission to go to a zoo or a sanctuary and it is accredited by AZA or it is accredited by GFAS, that is your way of helping. And that's the best way you can help. And, you know, the GFAS you can go on their website, or sometimes the facilities will have their accreditation on their own website, and just really do your research ahead of time. Look at the Form 990 financial statements, see where their money's going to. So throughout right. that whole film, the biggest, the one time I kind of had an outburst was that place that we don't name in Carolina, saying that money went towards conservation.
Right.
How
right.
much?
Yeah.
How right. much? And then,
well,
like,
Dave, if you look into it, most of those conservation groups are themselves. So
yeah,
a lot of
exactly.
times that money is going right back in the back door. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Right. And where I was on the, you know, this morning, just being a nerd, on the Denver Zoo's financial Form 990, looking at how much they contribute to conservation every year. And it's just, you know, hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars every year, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. so I think that's the best way people can help. It's really great that you want to see animals, but if you go to a place that isn't accredited, you're not really seeing animals because you like animals. You're seeing animals for yourself.
Right.
So I think that was really important. And then a couple of the points in terms of what makes a true sanctuary. I mean, the reality of it is, if they didn't have all this drama, would it be 3 weeks number one on Netflix? Probably not. That's just the downfall of the film industry. But, you know, a lot of those things were really blown out of proportion. They were Joe was criticizing the way Carol has her food and water dishes. Mm-hmm. And they focused on that. But I mean, that's how you monitor food and water intake in captivity. Those are important things that you can't not. I mean, at turpentine, they monitor it every single day. They know how much each animal ate every single day. Because guess what? If an animal hasn't eaten in a couple of days, then Emily's going to start to look into it. Mm-hmm. A lot of these things were really blown out of proportion to appear dramatic, but were actually very methodic and scientifically accurate in terms of what goes on in animal care.
Yeah, it was good animal husbandry is what she was doing. Yeah.
And, let's just say this, that also a true sanctuary shouldn't have to be here. So
exactly.
Really, all in all, the whole point is for us to get laws changed and to go out of business.
Yes.
So
yes.
The people that are in that docuseries are some of, not excluding Carol and Big Cat Rescue, mm-hmm. the crazy people are out there that have created this problem. I mean, they're some of the biggest hands in the market of selling, buying, trading animals, breeding. And so if it weren't for a lot of these people, sanctuaries wouldn't even have to exist. There shouldn't be. We have 89 animals, Chris.
Wow.
10 are bears. We have 77 cats.
Wow.
I mean, there should not, you know, they shouldn't have been homeless to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. No, I just want to jump in too real quick. When we say the one in Carolina that won't be named, it's not Carolina Tiger Rescue. We did a interview with Katie Cannon. That one is a real rescue sanctuary. It's
That's
the
correct.
One in the series.
They're also GFAS accredited Carolina
right,
Tiger.
Right.
It's just, yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah. And it's amazing the work you're doing. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say there, you know, yes, we'll make sure to point out Carolina Tiger Rescue is amazing. We've also a few years ago formed what's called the Big Cat Sanctuary Alliance. And that's also a great resource to go on and look into. And so it's all true sanctuaries that are following the same set of standards, the same goals, supporting the Big Cat and Public Safety Act. And so that's a group of us that have aligned, which Carolina Tiger is also part of. So when we say the word also, the place in North Carolina, you know, there's a couple of them mm-hmm. that are pretty bad out there. I mean, mm-hmm. we can touch on that later when we're discussing some laws, but, that place isn't the only, that character isn't the only one out there.
No, there's a bunch. So really quick on the, you said you had 77 big cats.
Yeah.
Can you break that down by type? What type of cats you have?
I don't have the numbers in front of me. Most of them are tigers. It's in the 40s of tigers. We also have lions, cougars, leopards, African servals, one Savannah cat, bobcats, and we also have ligers. And then we have the infamous, you know, create your own species, tie liger. So that's, you know, Joe and his people. I think they used to claim they were going to recreate the saber-toothed tiger, if anybody wants a good laugh. But
yeah.
So they found that these ligers, which are half lion, half tiger, the males might be sterile, but the females can reproduce. So now they're breeding them back to tigers, back to lions, and, you know, ligers, tie, I mean, name it. These aren't even, they're not even true species. And that's another thing I'm worried about with these people. Why did they start making their own species? Is there going to be a way that they can't be protected because they're not even a true species?
Yeah, and they try to argue that ligers were natural in the wild, and it's just a bunch of bunk. Yeah.
And that's a big thing that people. A question I get so often is, you know, what about reintroducing into the wild? Because that's another spin that a lot of these places will play. But the reality of it is they've never released a tiger back into the wild. There's just nowhere for them to go. They did it. IFA did it once, but it was a rescued and rehabilitated tiger called Cinderella. But so when you're saying you're doing it for conservation, again, coming back to that point, that common sense point is how?
Right.
Right. Yeah, especially when the genetics aren't there.
No.
Right.
Yeah, it's
until recently, believe it or not, the ESA, the Endangered Species Act, in section 17.2, that's how they got away with this for so long. Because, you know, you say it's an endangered species, how could they be allowed to breed it? Because you're legally by the ESA, you're really not allowed to do that unless you're licensed. And in that section, the generic tiger, or, you know, when you take a Bengal and, you know, an Indo-Chinese tiger and breed them together, that's a generic tiger. Mm-hmm. It's not one or the other. It's something new. They were exempt. Thankfully, they modified that very recently. But, you know, that's how complicated the laws are. And I'm sure Emily can tell us much more detail about that.
Yeah. You know, and Dave knows that my big thing is complicated the laws. There's so many loopholes, but also there's a very, very big problem with who is enforcing them. And that's typically what we see on a rescue, you know, especially when you go into a state that's supposed to have laws, you know, or you're rescuing your own state that laws were passed in 2005. You know, why isn't this being regulated?
Right. Yeah, it's a big problem. Do we have an idea of breakdown of cats, how many there are in the U.S.? I mean, we've done some digging, and I think the best estimate I saw was one that – I think it was Texas. Like, there was 2,000 tigers in Texas, but people just underreport, obviously. So do we have an estimate of, like, say, how many tigers or lions there are privately held?
I would say absolutely not. Yeah. You know, everybody – just because it's so unregulated, everybody has a different idea. And years ago, the United States Humane Society came out with a number of, you know, there's between 10 and 20,000 big cats in the U.S. And since everybody's kind of freaked out about that, well, you know, when you go on, USDA, which by the way is licensed exhibitors only. And so a lot of people were going off of that. You know, you have your numbers of AZA and how many are in those facilities. There's around 500 or more in sanctuaries. You know, if you're not USDA exhibiting, meaning open to the public, there's no telling how many are in somebody's backyard or the menagerie in Zanesville, Ohio, when that guy decides to release 56 exotic animals. You know, we were on a rescue in 2012 right here in the state of Arkansas. And we get to the property, and the woman, we entered the property with the sheriff's department. The woman actually had no idea how many cats she had. And it took us hours, and we had to go back the next day to recount because the caging was just beyond. I mean, it was one of the most dangerous rescues we've ever been on. But ends up there was 34 cats, you know, and most of them were tigers. There was a couple cougars and a couple leopards. That's it. So, you know, that's the kind of numbers that people aren't thinking about, you know, or trying to deny. So I stick with the, I would say 5,000 to 7,000 tigers, you know, registered. Right. I think there's almost 2,000. And so think of all the unregistered. And then let's, you know, we haven't even gotten into the cub petting and how many are born, you know, which also we don't know that exact number. But also, do they survive? That's the other big question.
Right, right. David, did you have any better data or things that you've been digging?
I think Emily definitely made a good point. I mean, when I first was an intern at Turpentine almost 10 years ago, during that era, I would say there was absolutely 5,000 to 7,000 in the U.S., 100%. During that time, I would give presentations, and it was, I would update this one slide talking about tigers for sale. No one would believe me, but every time I gave the presentation, it was a new screenshot from Craigslist. Since then, you know, they're smart. They're smart people. And since then, they've gone underground. It's very hard to find them for sale on the internet. It's pretty much impossible. So I think what I'm trying to get at, the scary thing here, is we don't know it at all, because it's so underground and they've gone so dark.
Well, when I was down in Florida, I didn't get to share this a couple weeks ago, but the club I was advising went out to this this old woman just right there near Gainesville, University of Florida. And she had, I think, 4 tigers and like 2 lions in horrific conditions. And the club was helping build new exhibits, but those were her private pets. That was
right.
I mean, you know, she could legally do that in Florida. So yeah, it's a huge, huge issue here. So I guess kind of moving on, you know, why is it a bad idea to own these big cats? And I'm saying that from a standpoint of somebody buying a cute cub thinking, oh, it's only $500 or $1,000, you know, cost of a purebred dog. And, you know, I guess if you can kind of talk to our listeners about, you know, how much it costs, vet care, all of that stuff that goes into it.
Well, our facility, we are quite large. You know, the costs vary, you know, and what people don't, there's an operating budget, right? Mm-hmm. And so right now we have 89 animals, and our monthly budget is $140,000 each month. So, you know, depending on the care that you're giving them. Now, we also are very fortunate. A lot of our food is donated. So we don't have that. The cost in vet care, that varies. It depends on the animal. You know, we have rescued some that are in relatively okay health. They might be severely obese, which is also very detrimental. But then you have, you know, 1 tiger, you know, 3 that were severe metabolic bone disease. So the cost of vet care for them has just been phenomenal. Yeah, I mean, just outrageous. And so that varies. So on average for us, what we've always said is it's about $10,000 or so per cat.
Now, you talked about getting food donated. So approximately how much does each big cat eat per day?
That also depends. It's just like people, to be honest. So, you know, we might have 1 tiger that weighs, you know, 350 pounds and eats about 7 to 9 pounds, depending on the time of year too, that lessens.
Right.
But you know, that another tiger could be 400 pounds and he might only get 5 pounds a day. Why? Well, he doesn't exercise enough or something. I don't know, but they just, you know, it's just like people. I mean, whether they're going to, and then we have another tiger that eats 15 pounds a day right now.
Wow.
And has for the last, since we rescued them, you know, and in the winter, a few of our cats, will eat about 17 to 18 pounds.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So a lot.
Yeah. We went through, I don't have our exact numbers on hand, but, it was over 300,000 pounds of raw meat last year.
Wow. Geez.
Yeah. Yeah. So a lot.
Yeah. 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 And so, it's quite expensive. One thing I was thinking about what you're talking about. Oh, go ahead, David.
I was just going to say that that's another point in the film that most people don't realize is when they only said they only had like 50 pounds of meat left mm-hmm. for 100+ cats, yeah. You know, it's a lot of care. And that's not something, especially the way that carnivore metabolism works. That's not something you can.
And also, I hope, you know, they also
really skip over.
They also didn't put in there, you know, they talked a lot about this donated meat. Well, yes, we get a lot of donated meat, and thankfully, you know, one of our biggest supporters is Tyson Foods. So, but we don't just throw the animal a piece of chicken, you know, it has to have all these vitamins put on it. You know, they need taurine. They also get glucosamine, chondroitin for arthritis. And, you know, and then they're showing in the film, here's my barrel of meat and I'm going to dump it in the middle of this enclosure. You know,
it was horrific.
Yeah. And from a welfare perspective, you know, I didn't see much in those barrels that you would feed out. You know, it was a lot of sausage and things that you aren't going to feed out to the cats, especially with the cats. You have to be really careful, again, with their metabolism, the way they store fat. It is a welfare issue if you're feeding them the wrong diets, because they'll wind up with, you know, fatty livers and things like that. So just bringing the science back to a lot of the flaws in that film that they really didn't point out.
No, it was, again, like I said, I tried to look at it from the animal's perspective, and processed meat, bologna. I mean, I'm thinking of all the nitrates, and you're right, from a physiology standpoint, those animals at Joe Exotic's place were absolutely not, their requirements were not being met through donated expired meat from Walmart. It was horrifying to watch that. And that's probably
Walmart's
what you're seeing.
Going to have something to say about all this now.
I'm sure. It's like, I'm careful on who I name. I don't want to get a lawsuit.
Yeah.
But, and it's not the company's fault, but it was just, you know, that's where they were getting this expired meat from. And yeah, it was horrifying.
Well, there's laws around that too. There's laws around that too. So, you know, there's a number of laws that are broken in that movie, pretty much all around.
Right. Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you, Emily, we're talking about vet care. Can you talk about the ligers that you have, or maybe even do you have some white tigers, like the physiological problems they might have?
Yeah, we have, quite a bit of white tigers. We also have a few ligers, and then I told you about the Thai liger.
Right.
Those guys, honestly, from what we've seen, we've had ligers that we rescued in the past. Haven't really seen many problems with them. You know, there's all these myths, like nothing actually has ever been proven or studied on them. So there's a myth of, you know, they just keep growing and growing, and they get so big that their heart can't keep up with them, which probably has happened, you know, but there's just really no studies that have been done on them. And then everything you hear about white tigers is a myth, people, you know, it's a color variant, but these guys, I'm sure almost everybody in the world has seen a picture of Kenny, the white tiger that was deformed in the face. Mm-hmm, well, mm-hmm. We rescued Kenny, and he lived his life out here. And, other than the deformity in his face, he was pretty healthy. He did get skin cancer at the age of 10. So, but all of these guys are, cross-eyed. Mm-hmm. They all are, just not all of them show that. It's not visible to us. So, you know, we have some that are cross-eyed. Do I see a difference in them? Yes, I do. They definitely have depth perception issues. You know, like, for instance, one of them might come up to the fence for a treat or for his medicine and you know, might bump into the fence. So we definitely see that. Again, there's nothing proven here, but we've definitely seen a lot more cancer. In the white cats at our facility. So, But we have pure white. We have then the other, you know, just typical white. And then we also have two strawberry, or tabby tigers, they call mm-hmm. them, which, you know, is even more inbreeding. Wow. And so there's been myths around, you know, let's just say, you know, certain magicians, that, you know, started this whole, this is a royal white tiger. There's nothing. It's mm-hmm. that it's fake, you know, mm-hmm. but people became fascinated with them. So this, you know, everything comes back to the dollar sign, Chris. So then the yeah. breeding just went crazy. Now we, in 2016, we actually, spearheaded one of the largest rescues of cats in the country so far. And I say so far, cause there's these other places we saw in the series that hopefully get shut down, but we partnered with another organization and actually purchased this facility in order to shut it down. And they were dealing, we got all of the USDA records mm-hmm. included in that, which was shocking and alarming. And so this facility had 76 or 78 people going in and out of it, dealing animals, either bringing them in from people or selling them. Mm-hmm. And all those characters in, you know, in the Tiger series were dealing animals out of there too. And of course, a lot of them were white, and they were specifically breeding white because they were dealing with another magician in Vegas, mm-hmm. you know, and that's what people want to see. So it's all about the dollar.
It is. So how rampant is cub petting today in 2020? Is that still going on quite a bit
Absolutely.
Around the United States?
Yeah, it is. And in fact, our education team, and this is, again, only USDA licensed facilities, so, which we should have a conversation about that.
Yeah, but, we have, yeah. But it's not very well done. It's bare minimum.
Right. And so in 2019, there were 41 known licensed facilities that were doing cub petting with big cats and bears. And bears are a whole nother issue.
Yeah.
On the same set of exploitation. So
it's terrible. And so you, David, you talked about it's hard to find where they're selling them now today. So has that been really pushed underground? Like it's not so easy to buy a tiger cub now.
Yeah. I would say it's primarily people who know people. Like I said, I've spent hours on the internet mm-hmm. trying to find just examples or just trying to find what I used to be able to find online. And there's private Facebook groups that are selling tons of exotics. But I think it's really a collective things. There's two sides of the story. There's the sanctuaries working together, and there's the breeders working together.
The bad guys.
I'm sure there was some sort of collaborative mm-hmm. effort. Yeah. I'm sure there was a collaborative effort to come off the online because, like I said, you'll find anything for sale on those exotic animal for sale pages on Facebook, but you won't find a tiger or a lion anymore.
I think that's because some laws have changed. I think that, you know, that a lot of these states that, if I could just talk about that money part of it. You know, when I go and speak at conferences or things, I decided that the best way to end my talks is with the dollar sign, because isn't that what the whole world's about? Mm-hmm. But for exotic animals specifically. So again, I've been rescuing animals with Turpentine Creek for just over 21 years. So years and years ago, and this is back when, you know, I'm trying not to say people's names either. Okay. So magicians, different things are selling animals, and so there weren't any laws regulating this. So people started breeding and selling tigers, and, you know, say they were making $10,000 to $20,000 a piece. That $20,000, of course, if it was a white tiger. Mm-hmm. And I have this right out of a breeder's mouth when we were rescuing animals, basically taking him out of business. And then because there weren't any laws, because somebody breeding and say they get 8 cubs a year, my God, you don't even have to go to medical school anymore, you know. You're making mm-hmm. a lot of money. So then more and more people started doing it. Well, then these exotic animal auctions became huge. And so people were making a fortune. Now more and more people start doing it again. All the way to you go in to an exotic animal auction and you're walking out of there with an African lion less than you can buy your cell phone these days.
Wow.
You know, we rescued a lion that was purchased for $350. You know, I mean, and people, this is when sanctuaries became so necessary because then they get scared. I don't know what to do with this animal. So now it's gotten even worse. And a lot of those, some of those states have changed laws and those exotic animal auctions aren't there. And I think that's Dave's point where a lot of this has gone underground. You know, now the big money, the big dollar sign is cub petting. So
right.
This facility that we took over and shut down was making $7,000 to $9,000 on a busy day or a busy weekend with two cubs, you know? And so they constantly, they're all working together because when those cubs are too big to use, they're thrown aside and the next ones are right there. They were either born there a week ago or they bought it from their buddy Joe. And that's honestly, I mean, we have the records to prove it. So that's the money now. And so if there are less animals, less tigers, less lions, I think in backyards, that's probably true, but because the money's not there anymore, the money is in the cub petting.
At that point, people have to realize that it's not an animal anymore, the way it's being treated. I mean, this is a product. It's a 100% business, right? So they breed the cub. The cub is the product making them money. But eventually, you know, just like a piece of machinery that starts to wear down, the cub gets too big.
Right.
And so then then you need to find, well, what happens to the adult? And that's just funneling what's going on even more and more. And then you got to breed new ones.
Right.
And it's absolutely nonstop.
Well, we heard in the docuseries that multiple times people saying, well, the animals disappeared.
Yes, that was my next question. That was my next question.
All right.
Really quick. So in there, Joe admits this place in Carolina said, and I wanted to get your take on this. So I was like dying to ask this question.
Yeah.
He said, when they're cubs, that's when they're the money makers. When they get older, they're nothing but a bill.
That's right.
So what happens to these tigers once they're old enough or get too old?
They're thrown aside. So, you know, when we took over that facility in Colorado, there was three white tiger cubs that were 4 months old that couldn't walk. They had such severe metabolic bone disease. Their bones were riddled with fractures. You know, we almost had to put them down. Thankfully we did save them. And so that's what happens. And a lot of them don't even survive that. Oh. From what I've been told, I don't know if it's true or not, but I do believe that maybe that place, Carolina, or I've also heard a place in Indiana, which that character was on too.
Yep.
They've have incinerators, and I've been told that multiple times. So now you're thinking those animals disappeared. Well, they either dealt it with their friend who's going to start breeding them, right? Especially if it's like a white tiger or a pure white, or they disappear. And now another character that we have dealt with in that film told us a lot about Joe, a lot about some behind the scenes stuff that he saw. And so we all know Joe went to prison, obviously, for murder for hire, but he also shot five tigers in the head.
Right.
Well, before that came out, we were aware that was being investigated and have been told multiple times that Joe would do this and shoot these animals. And then the cubs that were, quote unquote, expired from the cub petting, he would put them in the enclosure and then name them the same names.
Right.
Because why? Then your USDA records are all legit.
Right. Oh, there you go.
So, I mean, this is the loopholes that these guys are doing. So I definitely feel that most of those cubs don't survive. On the other hand, I bet if you were at one of these places, and God forbid, I'm not encouraging anyone to do this, but I bet if you were whispered in somebody's ear there and just said, hey, can I buy that cat after? I bet you'd have a phone number and email in your hand.
Right. So, David, you got anything to add?
It's just that, you know, that's again, down to the numbers. I mean, that's the scary part. You know, there's so much cub petting going on, but there's a supply chain here. And the end of that supply chain doesn't make sense. So where are all these other cats going? Are they alive? Are they not alive? Are they being transferred? I think it's all the above. We saw that in the film. So it needs to be regulated. We're talking, again, it may be a generic tiger, but we're still talking about an endangered species here.
Are they still doing cub petting at like malls and stuff, or is it just at their facilities?
Mostly it's just at their facilities now. Okay. A lot of that has, you know, people have gotten the word about and don't do. I mean, thankfully there's a lot of people that are protesting against that now, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, but we, you know, for another couple of cubs that did survive this, we just worked with PETA on a rescue, and you know, they went after this facility in Florida called Dade City Wild Things. And, they actually just finally won the case to where they can no longer have tigers. Sadly, there's still lions there. There's still some other big cats. So these two tigers, I mean, there's video, everything of Luna and Remington, that being doing the cub petting, and then Luna being drug around by her tail, almost like she was going to drown, because they were doing swimming with the cats too.
Oh, jeez.
Because you can do that a little bit longer because they're likely not going to kill you. Give me a break. So, you know, but then they get in trouble for this. And so Luna and Remington sat at a facility for 3 years waiting to be rescued. Hmm. And we were supposed to rescue 4 tigers. 2 of them, while sitting to wait to come to the sanctuary, escaped their holding enclosure where they were and were shot and killed. Oh, and then the judge relinquished Luna and Remington, which are now, you know, I mean, way past, you know, they just sat there. So nobody, even if they do make it out of this, who's protecting them and who's helping them find a home and get to a good sanctuary?
Right. Yeah. I think I remember hearing that, the tiger escape in Florida. Yeah. It's horrible. Here's a question, and I'm just going to throw it out there. It's something Angie brought up in our discussion and really got me thinking, because people would be surprised that the U.S. is one of the top wildlife trafficking destinations, I guess. Animal parts, stuff coming into the U.S., New York, San Francisco, L.A., big cities, being sold in the black market. Do you think some of these tigers might end up there because there's a lot of stuff with like tiger bone and things like that? Yeah,
I do. Go ahead, Dave.
It's more money. I was just saying it's still money.
Yeah.
Right. It's a lot more money.
It comes,
you know, so it's that's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
It
comes down to the dollar sign. And in the black market, I mean, yeah, who knows what's going on, you know? And I think, yeah. And years ago, a group called Traffic had put out, you know, when they were first discussing this, that there's more tigers in the United States than there are in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. So when tigers, and I say sadly when, because they are going to go extinct, because it's going to happen. We didn't do anything fast enough to help save them, right? We always wait till it's almost too late.
But
you know, the U.S. is going to be the number one target for that. And so, I mean, in 2003, there was a raid at a property in California. That's 2003. So that's some time ago, but it was going on then. In that raid, there was 90 tiger carcasses hanging and 58 tiger cubs found frozen in a deep freezer. So yeah, it's definitely going on.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's what we thought. I hadn't thought of it, and I was like, dang, that is a great point, because I'm sure some of them do end up there.
Well, just to, I have a quick thing to say on that. This is going to be kind of a little bit of a rant, but the real thing here is to just keep wildlife wild. And, you know, domestic animals, we bred them down from their wild ancestors. We bred them down for specific behavioral traits, proximity, and picking up on social cues. right? So that they can be better managed. And along with that, because of proximity, there's not as much of an issue when it came to zoonotic diseases. And the more we're constantly putting humans and wildlife together, as we now see with COVID, there's a lot of risk that comes out of that. There's a lot of risk,
right?
You know, so you have attacks, you have zoonotic diseases.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I'd love to touch on after we hit on the case of the Bronx Zoo is the psychology,
right,
of both the humans and the animals in what happens with that.
Okay, well, real quick. So, right, yesterday we read that a tiger has been infected with COVID. I just read a couple reports quickly that I think that a few other their animals had it too. They were coughing. They said that the animals are going to recover fine, but it just shows, you know, that this virus is just horrific, what's going on around the world right now. But I guess, what are you guys doing to protect your animals there, Emily? And I guess that kind of shows how these wildlife trafficking are spreading these deadly diseases.
Right. Yeah. Well, first of all, I pray that, you know, those animals do recover. Now, so one of them tested positive, a 4-year-old tiger. So all of the other cats, not the lions and tigers, have the same symptoms. But there's so much unknown about this pandemic right now, which is super, mm-hmm. super scary. And so, yeah, you have to, you know, a lot of us colleagues at a lot of different sanctuaries were like, wow, what if this does hit the wild population, you know, mm-hmm. and if these mm-hmm. cats recover, and I hope they do, and when they do, you know, what was given to them to help them along with their recovery? And would that be possible in the wild? Or is this something that could kill them? So that's really scary. When this started going on, we are one of the largest sanctuaries that's open to the public every day. We're very, very big into education. So everybody that comes through here is going to go on a guided tour, and they're going to understand about cub petting and get educated about white tigers. And, you know, we want them to understand why sanctuaries are a necessity and why we have to exist. Immediately, we closed our doors. And mm-hmm. a few days after, things started getting really, you know, what's going on, this stay at home. So we decided to quarantine. And that means no animal care staff leaves or
right.
anything on the property. And of course, our interns are here and they help us with everything, all the daily care of these animals, everything from feeding and, you know, food prep and medicating and habitat maintenance and things like that. So obviously this is a scary time in our country. And, you know, said, look, this is what we're doing. You cannot come and go. You have to stay on this property permanently until, you know, the risk is over. And they, all 15 of them were like, we're in it. We're in it for the animals. And so we feel pretty comfortable and safe at this time. Mm-hmm. Obviously the Bronx, obviously it's New York City area. That area is, you know, the hottest spot. Yeah. So, I think I feel that we're pretty safe right now. We are
good,
keeping our distance, you know, from the animals as much as we can, but to all of us right now, it's kind of like Survivor. We're just fenced in.
Yes. I think everybody around the world today. Yeah.
Right. I'm starting to understand what it feels like to be an animal in captivity.
Yeah.
You know, but but it's great. I mean, we get to go and do our job every day and right. still, you know, take care of these animals and know that you're making a difference. And it's just been fulfilling. And, you know, so we are very, very fortunate to be where we are. And the animals at Turpentine Creek are definitely, in my opinion, safe.
Yeah. Yeah. Dave, do you have anything to add on the COVID-19 infection?
I think it's just a matter of there's just way too much, you know, like with the wet markets and all the endangered species going on with these animals in the wild. I mean, that's why in the beginning we went back to the point that we can never release a tiger. I mean, the problem is still so massive. We were talking about, well, what's true conservation? And so when we're looking at true conservation and finding more habitat and minimizing poaching and minimizing the presence in these wet markets and things like that, you know, it's still there. And this is just a result of that, those unmanaged policies and laws and regulations around wildlife.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then you mentioned the psychology, so maybe we can talk about that. I mean, I think people get a good idea on the psychology of people that own big cats like Joe Exotic, but
do they?
So I'm because I was thinking about this morning because I saw one article on this, and so I'd love to talk about that because I know a lot of people were, I was trying to figure out the best way to explain, you know, people are always like, Emily has this saying of interacting with a tiger is like playing with a loaded gun. You know, you're just flipping it around and waiting for it to go off. But there's also a massive difference when you're pulling these cubs from their mother and raising them as a human. Because again, remember I said earlier, they're not domestics. You know, there's universal body language, but there's a lot of difference between humans and domestics versus the wild side of animals. And so I think it's just an interesting comparison because these animals are so incredibly unpredictable and incredibly messed up in the head when you're talking about development of a young animal. And I think it's kind of ironic in a way because it's comparable to a lot of the characters in these films. You know, the number of personality disorder signs that you see in this film are extraordinary.
Yes.
In all of them. You know, you have narcissistic personality disorder in the film. You have histrionic personality disorder. And what I think is interesting is those all come from problems in growth and development and how they were raised as kids. And so I think it's a great way to point out, like, that's the same thing with these tigers. Just because you're raising them, the human is raising them and, you know, quote unquote, trying to get them accustomed to people. They're just not normal. You know, they're not normal from the inbreeding. They're not normal from how they're raised and it makes them so dangerous and so unpredictable.
Yeah. It's the one study that we kind of have an idea of how many generations it takes to kind of domesticate an animal. And it's just that silver fox study out of Russia where I think it was like 50 generations to get them to.
Right. And they got a dog.
Yeah.
They got something that looked like a dog.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So yeah, for sure. These animals are definitely not domesticated. So I a couple final questions because, you know, we're well over an hour and we could probably talk for four.
Yeah.
From your standpoint, is Tiger King going to hurt or help sanctuaries?
Well,
it's a tough one. Yeah.
You know, I think things like this that people are doing and, you know, if we can all feed off of this talk right now of what's a good sanctuary. And I think that definitely will help. I'm very concerned of the ramifications of this film, because it bloated these guys' head even more. And, you know, I don't even know the numbers of how many millions of people watched this, but out of those millions, I'm so scared of how many people are going to think, well, I'm going to go buy one now. And,
right.
And did we start this cycle all over where I feel like we've been making progress over the last 20 years? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's a little frightening. I hope we can, you know, just keep educating people on all of this.
Right, right. David, do you have a take on that?
Yeah. I think that this is the biggest opportunity that these animals have had and potentially will. It's sort of like Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers book, where you have this coming out right when people were quarantined, right when they have nothing else to do but watch Netflix. And so I think in terms of a global attention, that it's a massive opportunity for the cause.
Right.
I think it's definitely a hit or miss. What I have observed on social media and just based on what people have given me, the feedback that they've given, I would say that the millennial generation gets it.
Right.
they have opinions about the people side of the story, but there was a relatively, I saw one over the last 4 weeks, I saw only one post that was for going and petting a tiger.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that's a pretty good sign. And where I'm coming from with that is comparing to the last time there was a big attention around exotic animals like this. I'm not sure if you heard of him, was the real Tarzan.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
When he became popular on Instagram.
Yep.
People were definitely all about hanging out with leopard cubs and mm-hmm. baby chimpanzees when he was around. I think that the shock that people have received that there are people this crazy out there mm-hmm. behaving this way around these animals was enough to maybe shed a little light. Unfortunately, you know, as Emily said, and we can all agree, the film didn't do the animals much justice
no,
at all.
No.
I just think that the attention right now is there. And anyone that is passionate about this mission, like Emily's doing nonstop, is realizing that this is the time to really roar.
Right. It is. That's a good one. Yeah.
Paying attention.
Yeah. That's a good point. That's a good point. So where are we with the laws right now? I know they mentioned the bill, and the bill's like got a very little chance of passing in at the federal level here in the United States, but are laws changing state by state as well to benefit these animals?
That's one of my favorite topics, Chris. No, it's, you know, there's a lot of issues with the laws, you know? So the biggest thing is the loopholes that are there that people can get around all of this. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So states that have passed laws, that's awesome. Right now, there's still four states that have no laws. But even the states that have passed them, again, who's responsible for making sure that this is going on? You know, there's 14 states that require a permit. Let's talk about how easy that is to get one. But, you know, a lot of these states, it might be up to the sheriff's department. There's in fact, you know, I want to know, how do these sheriffs, you know, we saw what happened in Zanesville. You know, there was a lot of talk about that, how, oh, why were the animals all shot and killed? Well, you know, there's a lot that goes behind of what happened. But when you're a sheriff, you don't go, or a police officer, you don't go to school and get educated on what if a tiger or lion runs at you. But that also means that you're not educated in the fact of what's the proper containment for that animal, what's the proper diet. And so we have a lot that's what's lacking in all the laws that are there and are in place. I mean, again, we got the law changed in Arkansas in 2005, and we've still been rescuing animals in Arkansas, you know, so there's that. And then you have USDA and in so many ways around it. And, you know, the inspectors for USDA are highly trained, and they're supposed to be, you know, upholding and enforcing the Animal Welfare Act and all of this. But if you're not licensed, then no one's telling you what to do, which that's why we have these backyard breeders, you know?
Yeah.
But also there's a huge problem there. So now you have USDA, and by the way, these reputable facilities, I mean, when they come and we get inspected, it could be 4.5 to 5 hours long,
mm-hmm.
but then we're seeing places like Joe's and, you know, these other places in there that, how is this going on? And I will fight for the USDA inspectors. There's too few of them in this country.
Right. Right.
You know, yeah. I mean, some inspectors are assigned to 100 facilities or 130 that I've even spoken to, you know, and by the way, they're federal employees. And so do some math there. There's 365 days in a year. Well, you know, if you do the math on vacations and weekends and holidays, they work about 21 days a year, you know? Yeah, so if you're supposed to be inspecting and upholding, the Animal Welfare Act, like then there's not enough time in the day to even do that. And then there's inspectors that are inspecting exotic cats, but they're also inspecting a research lab, and they're also having to deal with puppy mills,
right.
You know? So we need, that's the kind of stuff in the laws that I think needs to change. Not only, yes, of course, we want the Big Cat and Public Safety Act to get passed. We have an entire advocacy page on our website that will help you do it. It's a click of a button. It'll send, you know, your representative a letter straight from you. But, you know, we need it to be a separate division. and people actually enforcing the laws. And that's what I see is just a big failure in this country and why these guys are doing what they're doing. I mean, all the way from, we've been on rescues where there were 18-year-old kids that were there working and some of these animals were licensed in their name. Or, you know, so-and-so on another rescue who may or may not have been in that film, we didn't know because we got to the facility and there he was, and it was a facility in a girlfriend's name, even though he can no longer have a license in his name. So you know what I mean?
Right.
There's just too many loopholes. And then you have people to avoid their state laws, even if their state has a law, they're actually applying for a USDA license, even though these animals are their pets, just so they can now avoid their state law.
it's a crazy
circle.
Yeah, it's complex. It's very complex.
I was going to say, I think they really need to just come up with a comprehensive plan and at least go around with tigers. You know, they're the biggest problem. This is so political. This is so complex. There's so many loopholes, like Emily was talking about. There's so much around who's going to, you know, take the initiative to be responsible for all this. But I think that if we started with at least one of the big cats and make it tigers, because they're the biggest problem, there would be enough proof there to continue forward, if that makes sense.
Yep. Yep. But
there needs to be something
right
pretty quick.
Yeah, I know.
I don't know. I think we got to stick with the big cat thing, Dave, because, you know, we're producing animals that aren't even true species, right? They're producing ligers and tie ligers.
Right.
And I think that's their way around it. You know what I mean? If we're going to go and protect the endangered species, well, then I'm going to make my own. I mean, you know, one more thing that these guys, I think that they're creating their own new loophole. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And this is how complicated it gets. Cause now I'm sitting there thinking, well, if it has tiger genes in it, is it still considered a tiger?
Right.
Or not?
Probably
right. So
not.
That's
illegally.
How complicated it gets.
Yeah.
Right. So, but they need to do, they need to come up. I think the point is like, they need to come up with one comprehensive plan and give it a try. And get it done already.
And do you guys think that it's a possibility of this not passing with the Tiger King coming out? Or do you think more people are going to support it?
I hope more people support it. It's going to take an election, I think. I don't know.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It's another topic.
Yeah.
Well, they had a great, they were saying in the film is like, what happens is like, we come in. And then the next day they show up with the Cubs.
I know.
Up on Capitol Hill.
And all the politicians with it.
They're not the only ones. There's a lot of, clearly, and by the way, I've been there. Carol Baskin and Howard with Big Cat Rescue. So they're not the only ones that are showing up there with Cubs, though. There's some quote unquote zoological facilities that are also fighting against this.
Right.
That aren't AZA, you know?
Right.
And so. Yeah. I mean, you got that part in there too. Why? Let's go back to the dollar sign, guys.
Money.
It's right. money. And they're going to breed because babies bring money, no matter if you're touching them or they're in your facility. That's bottom line for these people.
Then it goes right back to like getting really, really political, where it's like a lot of them will say, well, it's my freedom and right. You know, in a free country to own a tiger.
And then
you got to go even more political and say, well, it's not a domestic, it's an endangered species. So is it really a right?
Well, I know.
We've always said that this is about as dangerous as it really is. The exotic animal exploitation and trade is about as dangerous as illegal drugs and guns in this country. And look, rewatch the docuseries. You have all three combined into one. You should be scared.
I know. Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of these people do scare me. So final question. How can we help you in your efforts, Emily and David? Not just education, but is there other things our listeners can do?
Absolutely. First of all, we mentioned it before, but do your homework and do your research first. and understand that there's a very, very serious problem with exploitation of big cats in this country. You know, what I've noticed, and I definitely want to push viewers to our website. Again, there's an excellent education and advocacy stuff on there. And check out our social media, especially during this time. We're trying to go live on Facebook twice a day just so people know what we're doing. But also, you know, social media has made it so easy for people to have a voice, but at the same time, again, educate yourself first. And you can do that by checking out True Sanctuaries. Go to the Big Cat Sanctuary Alliance. See the sanctuaries that are all part of that. Go to GFAS, the Global Federation of Animal Sanctuaries, and, you know, check out the accreditations and verifications on that, and do everything you can to support sanctuaries. And if we all work together, I hope, you know, one day we can see this all come to an end.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Just to piggyback off what Emily said, I would say is just be overall, just be smart and do your research. Make sure that your money is going to a legitimate organization. And not only that, be smart with your money on a daily basis. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you need to buy something, Turpentine Creek has a great shop online with tons of everyday items available, and all that money goes straight to the refuge. So instead of supporting Amazon, you can get something just as cool from a lot of these sanctuaries. Again, Turpentine Creek has the shop on their website there, and that's going straight to the animals.
Well, thank you both. It's a long time. I mean, I know we could keep talking, but you know, went a little long, but it's just fascinating from your perspective. And I know our listeners are going to appreciate this, but I will definitely make sure all those links are on our show notes too, so our listeners can go there and go to your website and find the GFAS and these other stuff. David, I'm going to put your TED Talk on there where you kind of address some of this stuff too. So bravo on that. But thank you both so much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I really appreciate you having us on, Chris, and spreading the word about our mission and our views.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much. Okay.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.